When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hello everybody and welcome to the greatest games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. Today with Jonathan and myself, we have Nicholas Blinko, author, writer of the most recently published More Noble Than War, A Soccer History of Israel-Palestine. Nicholas, pleasure to have you here.
Really good to be here.
Now, you've gone for the most niche game so far that we've had on this particular podcast.
Well, it's not niche if you're Israeli. It's the big game.
And there's the point, everybody. You've gone for, we go back to 1928, the Lord Mon-sponsored Tel Aviv derby between Maccabi and Hapoel. Over to you, Nicholas. I'll be honest with you, I don't know much about this at all.
Well, the reason that this match is such a kind of conflict in itself is that the Hapoel team, which at the time were called Allenby, which is a street in Tel Aviv, Allenby had split with Maccabi, so they're actually Maccabi's youth team. And they got so angry with the Maccabi organisation that they'd first split and then they'd signed up with the rival socialist trade union movement, which is, they have a sports association called Hapoel, which means the workers in Israel. And they'd become the kind of flagship socialist team. So Maccabee, which was really the team of the bosses. It was the team of shop owners, builders, property magnates, the kind of old guard or the core of Tel Aviv, which was a new city, but it was already 30 years old. So it had this kind of old guard there. They set up the Maccabee, and then their workers, who kept going on strike and arguing with them, signed up their youth team, and it just became a really, really rivalrous conflict. They didn't even play each other at all for 2 years. Mm-hmm. So it took quite a lot of organisation even to get the first Tel Aviv derby off the ground.
Do you want to explain a little bit about the Maccabee movement and sort of its ideals and why, I guess, from the very start, there's this politicised aspect to sport in Palestine?
Yeah, well, the Maccabee wasn't originally called the Maccabee. It was a gymnastics association based in Jaffa. This was before Tel Aviv even existed. Russian Jews who'd moved to Jaffa from the 1890s onwards set up a gymnastics association in 1905. And there were gymnastics associations appearing all over Europe. And what they mean by gymnastics at the time is basically calisthenics. They were standing, doing drills, holding clubs.
So this is the idea of Turnen you have in Germany, this sort of a way of preparing the body for physical activity in which war is somehow kind of implicit.
Yes. In fact, it was a Czech movement called the Sokol, which were the big influence on them. But yeah, it was drill. They were a kind of paramilitary organisation, and they were very much about Jewish self-defence. They were, and in fact, the guy who was put in charge of them was a Russian soldier, and he was put in charge because he was a security officer for the farms of the local businessmen. So this guy, Zvi Nishri, who at the time was called Zvi Orlov, was put in charge of them. And he was there because he was a soldier, and he was training the young men to be fit, but also training them in self-defense. The strange thing about Nishri is that he wasn't actually Jewish. He was part of a kind of Christian Russian millenarian, almost Protestant-style Christians who'd gone so far back to basics that they'd kind of rejected the New Testament and become, well, kind of saw themselves as Jews. And there were so few Jews at the time that they were kind of accepted.
Well, I think that's worth sort of, I'm aware of the kind of danger to adding layer of background, but just sort of explaining the situation in Palestine around the time of the First World War and then the first decade or so afterwards.
Yeah, well, before the First World War, Palestinian Arabs were by far the biggest majority, but there were big Jewish communities.
And it's part of the Ottoman Empire at the time.
And it's part of the Ottoman Empire, yeah. So there's a community in Jaffa, which is predominantly Russian. There's a community in Jerusalem, which is less political and much, much more religious. I mean, this all gets very involved, but there's a society called the Sons of Moses, who basically set up Tel Aviv and set up organisations and institutes like the Maccabee, which becomes Maccabee Tel Aviv just before the First World War. The Maccabees being a group of Jewish revolutionaries in Greek time. So they're looking.
And then the word means hammer, is that right?
It means hammer in Aramaic, and Judah Maccabee is the hammer of the Jews.
Right.
So he was the great revolutionary of the Greek era. So they're looking back to that. They set up the Maccabees, and but it's still really an athletic, it's really a gymnastics self-defense association.
So where did the football side of things then come in?
Well, it's because the very youngest kids liked football. Football was really taking off. It had been the flagship event at the, I believe, 1908 Olympics in London. Mm-hmm. Kids really loved football. And then two French brothers came and visited Tel Aviv, and they introduced some coaching.
Did they introduce sort of organised football, or was it just the coaching side of things they brought in?
They must have brought in the organised side, because suddenly you're getting team photographs, which didn't exist before. People are wearing strips.
Right.
They're actually wearing the same strips. So I'm not quite sure how the games worked, but, you know, by that point, there were three sports associations. There were the Maccabee, Tel Aviv, Maccabee, Petah Tikva, and third Maccabee Association. But they're all very close to each other. And they're all wearing the same strip, but they start playing each other, and they play each other at an annual games festival, which is, again, is mostly wrestling and gymnastics.
I was going to say this. How did football then sort of come in? As obviously you said about the two French guys that sort of introduced it. Were, I don't know, more traditionalists or people into more gymnastics, maybe older generations, were they suspicious? Did they not care about football? How was it welcomed in by everybody?
It was treated with some suspicion. This, mm-hmm. It was seen. It's hard to think of this now, but football was seen as too individualistic.
Right.
That it didn't really teach the strength of the core. People get the ball and run off and do their own thing on the pitch. As far as I understand, there wasn't much tactics at the time. And certainly Zvi Nishri thought that it just didn't instill the discipline of the core. It was too wild and buccaneering and cavalier.
I mean, this is an exact parallel to what was happening in Central Europe. Mm. You had, you know, I mentioned the German idea of turnen in Hungarian, torna. So, yep. So Ferencváros's name is FTC and the T is torna. It's the Ferencváros torna club. So you see that loosely translated as gymnastics club, but that doesn't really explain what it is. It is this. Yeah, I think calisthenics is a much better way of translating it, but that's not even quite it, is it? It's a sort of a militarized, a community form of keep fit, and it's the British in Central Europe, and then the Hungarians, as my recent book, as I long ago explains, who carry that their style of football. I mean, presumably there was a British influence in terms of delivering football to Palestine as well, because it was St George's in Jerusalem.
Yeah, the British introduced it into their public schools, and the public schools were mostly for wealthy Palestinian Arabs.
So does it then sort of become a game of the elite?
It does for the Palestinian Arabs.
Right, okay.
And it's a game for the elite insofar as the Maccabee Club is a club of quite well-to-do Jewish people in Tel Aviv and Jaffa at the time. But by the 1920s, when the British are now in control, they've defeated the Ottoman Empire, the British are in control, there's new investment in Palestine. The government is a mix of both the British military authorities and a new organisation that's been set up to help govern Palestine called the Jewish Agency for Palestine. Because there's so much investment, and it's investment aimed at bringing a Jewish population into Palestine, you're getting all these Jewish workers coming in from industrial cities.
And I mean, what would have been the proportion of the population that was Jewish in say 1920 or 1925?
In the whole country, there were 85,000 Jews by that point. There'd been a lot of immigration.
Out of a total of...
That's 11%.
11%, right, yeah. Okay. So pretty small.
Yeah, so it's about 3/4 million people live in Palestine.
But Tel Aviv is an almost entirely Jewish city?
Tel Aviv is a suburb at this point in 1920, and it's got a population of maybe 15,000. Most people live in Jaffa. And by that point, it's pretty much half and half Arabic and Jewish. And then if you add Tel Aviv on, there is a Jewish ascendancy in the seaport, which is the Jaffa-Tel Aviv seaport. A lot of wealthy Russian Jews there. But suddenly there's all these working class Jews coming in from the cities that used to be the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which has just dissolved.
So they're fleeing the chaos post-First World War.
Yeah, and they're looking for work.
Yeah, which of course is why that Budapest school I talk about in my book is so influential on a global scale, because people were getting out of Budapest and I guess Austro-Hungarian Empire as a whole, because of economic chaos and political chaos, that there's mass emigration. And so the ideas that grew up there are taken around the world very, very quickly.
Yeah, in your book you speak about the younger players, and well, the younger people who became football players who came from the Austro-Hungarian cities. So there's a class, ethnic, obviously cultural difference, which you've mentioned, against established club members who were Russian and favoured gymnastics. Now, again, something you touched on earlier about maybe gymnastics versus football there. How did that then play out? Because we're into the 1920s, and of course, the derby that we're going to talk about is in 1928. So presumably, football is growing. There's more interest.
Yes. Well, the British are pumping. The British are encouraging it. They're starting leagues, which are to start off with, they're military leagues, but they decide to open them up to the population. There were friendly matches between the Maccabee and British military sides. So,
I mean, friendly in the looser sense.
Yeah, I mean, so you read the reports of some of them, and they say they were just hammering at each other, but they were intended to be friendly. I mean, there was a head of the Jewish, the deputy head of the Jewish agency, Colonel Kish, had been a British soldier and wanted there to be very close relationships and friendly relations. And he created the Shield of Samson, which was the first Jewish tournament to try.
That's a hell of a name for a tournament, isn't it? <I don't know>. Were long-haired players allowed in there?
The football in Maccabee is getting a little bit better. There's a guy called Lumek, which is a nickname. He's called Ratner, Lumek Ratner. And he'd played with the great Hakoa Vienna side, but he never played with the real side. He'd just been a part of the Hakoa, which is a Viennese sports association. He'd been there before the war. So, and he played football with them. And he brought this to Palestine. So he did have some knowledge of football tactics. And he was a decent player by all accounts. And so he was improving the Maccabee. He was, you know, teaching these kind of princes of the city, quite wealthy people, how to play. And they were getting better and they were playing the military sides. And one of the things that really exploded the popularity of football was the visit of Hakoa Vienna, which by 1925 was perhaps the best team in Austria, even though it was a Jewish side.
I'd say the best team probably in continental Europe. I mean, Hakoa, I think, a fascinating case that... Yeah, they were founded in 1909. They sort of really pick up just after the First World War. They get promoted, I think, 1920. But then they play West Ham, draw at home, beat them 5-0 in London.
Yeah,
I mean, I suspect not a full strength West Ham side, but nonetheless, given the status of English football at the time, this was an utterly incredible result. And if you read the
West Ham weren't even playing at the London Stadium at the time.
If you read the Daily Mail's match report, it speaks in absolutely glowing terms of Hakoa. Mm-hmm. This wasn't a freakish result. It was, I mean, how can 5-0 be a freak?
Sure.
They were a really, really good side, and then they win the Austrian League in 1925. And the Austrian League at that point was the only professional league outside of Britain in the world.
So it's an extraordinary fact that that Austro-Hungarian part of the world, as we know in the 30s, Austria and then Hungary and so on. That was the hotbed of really sort of world footballing talent, you'd say. At the time.
Yeah, and Hakoa Vienna really picked up on that. One of the reasons they were so good is that there was a rise in Austrian nationalism, and the other teams were really only drawing their players from this new country, Austria. But Hakoa Vienna went out to all of the cities of the old Austro-Hungarian Empire and were employing Hungarians like Bela Gutmann and...
Sándor Fábián?
Yeah.
Sándor Fábián, the great goalkeeper who... I mean, this is a story that you
Here we go.
Well, you know, you one of the reasons why sporting fiction fails is that the extraordinary stories you get in real life, when written down, when they're not real, sound ludicrous. Mm. So they go into the final game of the season, they need to win... and Sándor Fábián, their goalkeeper, breaks his arm, gets an arm injury. Anyway, his arm's in a sling. There's no substitutes on those. He goes out on the wing, and of course, he scores the winner to win them the league. I mean, it's a story you couldn't. Yeah, you if you scripted that, it would look absurd. I mean,
if it was Hollywood, you'd think, oh, come on.
It's Pelé coming off the bench and escaped to victory to score the overhead kick with his arm in a sling
after Sylvester Stallone has saved the penalty.
Before.
Oh, was it before that? Okay, yeah, I sometimes forget.
And of course, that was filmed at MTK's ground in Budapest. MTK, the sort of the non-militant Jewish club of Budapest. Anyway, I digress.
oddly relevant.
it's worth saying that Hakoa weren't in any sense just a sports team. They were set up specifically to promote the idea of muscular Judaism and also to raise funds for Zionism, to raise money to buy land in Palestine.
Absolutely. And we're going to talk about more about Hakoa and all this fascinating stuff after this.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the air in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
So one of the ways, you know, Hakoa made the money that they needed for, you know, to promote Zionism was tours.
Yes.
And they toured everywhere all the time. I mean, incredible schedules. And the tour that's relevant here is the one they make to the Middle East and North Africa.
Yeah,
two, don't they? 24 and 25.
25 and 26, I think.
Okay, sorry. Yeah.
So the February 1925 tour, they'd been to Egypt already. They played in Cairo and Alexandria, and once they were in Palestine, they played British sites in Haifa and Jerusalem. But the big one, the one that really changed everything, was the Hakoa Tel Aviv match. Tel Aviv train station was brand new at the time, and it was absolutely covered with people from dawn. By the afternoon, there were 10,000 people just waiting. Waiting to watch the match, and beforehand they had the drills, the calisthenics and the gymnastic displays. The big thing was forming a human menorah, which was like a human pyramid, but inverted to make it even more difficult.
Well, if you're going to talk about inverting pyramids, there's another book. But yeah, sorry, Nicholas, you were saying.
It was a phenomenally successful match. Obviously, Hakoa won quite easily. It was 5-1. And the story is that the one goal they allowed Ratner to score one goal as a
former player.
Yeah, as an old boy. But 5-1 wasn't really that bad by the time, and everyone expected the Maccabees to lose. And so football really, really took off. And then they came again the next year, where they absolutely hammered the Maccabees the next year. It was something like 12-1.
And that was the absolute height of Hakoa. So they arrived as league champions.
Yeah, yes, they were.
If it was early 26, they won the league in 25. Yeah. So.
And then the Maccabees went off to Vienna for a tour, but they left the youth team behind. Well, the youth team actually came from these cities. They could have visited relatives, and they certainly wanted to be paid to play football. And this was one of the few times where it was clearly professionalised, because people got a per diem. And were being paid to play football. So the youth team was just so angry that they resigned en masse. And they all, virtually all of them, lived on the same street, which is Allenby Street in Tel Aviv, which runs down from the highest ridge to the sea. So all the nicest houses were on the top of the ridge, and they lived, not slums, but they lived in poorer working Classic accommodation, running down to the sea.
See, people nowadays, they moan about young players wanting this, that and the other and going on strike and so on. It was happening in the 1920s.
Absolutely.
In Israel-Palestine, yeah.
The Allenby boys resigned. They all knew each other. In the end, they all seemed to have married each other's sister. So a guy called Noodleman married the sister of two brothers called Polyakov or Polyakov, I guess.
But they then join up with Hapoel, with this socialist organisation.
Yeah, that's the big thing. They were independent for a year as Allenby Tel Aviv, and then they sign up with Hapoel. And this is the future Labour Party, the big socialist organisation, really decide that they're going to stick it to the bosses by signing up these young rebels and making them the flagship team. And it's not even popular within the Labour movement, because there's already a Dockers team in Haifa who could conceivably be the flagship team and certainly regard themselves as being the first socialist team in Israel. But the flagship team is these young boys. But they still refuse to play. They start playing socialist teams elsewhere in Palestine, and they go on tours to play socialist teams abroad, but they just refuse to play Maccabee, and Maccabee refuse to play them. And it was because of the example of Hakoa, who by now are the kind of the world's Jewish team. Everyone who's Jewish knows Hakoa. Well, love them.
Hakoa went on a huge, I mean, in some ways, too successful a tour of the US and then down through Central America into South America in the summer of 1926. And they play a team, a sort of combined New York team, at the Polo Grounds in New York, and get a crowd of over 40,000, which is the biggest crowd for a soccer match in the US until Pelé joins the Cosmos in 50 years later, and almost 50 years later.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
So that's how big it was. But the problem is that once people in the US, once entrepreneurs start to see these vast crowds coming to watch this touring team, and they played 20-odd games, I mean, an extraordinary number of matches, those entrepreneurs think, hang on, there's money to be made here. So they start signing them. So there's two entrepreneurs in particular, Nat Agar and Morris van der Vega. Agar runs, let me get this the right way around, runs Brooklyn Wanderers. Van der Vega runs New York Giants, the two biggest New York teams. And yeah, they sign Gutman. And I think between them, they sign 9 players. And then Agar, the following summer, he decides that actually the real money is if you control not just the teams in the US, but also the touring side. So he gets an old Hungarian Jewish player called Arpad Deutsch to go around Central Europe and Palestine and find Jewish players to form a team called the Maccabees to go and tour around the US with the announcements made. They go to a hotel in New York when they arrive. They get the head of the US Zionist organization there, and the announcement's made 50% of all funds we make will be donated to the Zionist movement. But that tour was nowhere near successful, partly because the remnant of Hakoa also went on tour, and partly because all the good players are already playing in the US.
Absolutely amazing. Well,
Mond, who founded the ICI in Britain, saw the success of Hakoa, and he was so thrilled by Tel Aviv on his first visit. He became the world chairman of the Maccabee Association, put huge amounts of resources into it. But his big dream was to create another Hakoa, but one that just came from Palestine, was based around the Maccabee Tel Aviv side and would tour. But in order to create a national side in Palestine, a national Jewish side in Palestine, the teams had to start talking to each other. So that's why there was a Tel Aviv derby.
He wanted to pick players from both teams, so they combined.
Yeah, he wanted it to be a national side.
Right. But these two sides obviously had fallen out due to all the youth players and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So was he instrumental in sort of trying to get them in the same room?
Yes, he was. He sponsored them and then sponsored a tournament. He was also very close to a guy called Yekutieli.
Yeah, I don't think anybody will question it.
Well, his daughter might, who's still alive.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
He was very close to to this guy, Yekitieli, who wanted to join the Olympic movement. At this time, FIFA is still part of the Olympic movement. Mm. So it's a way to become a member of the Olympic movement and have a national Jewish side, which would be a Palestinian side, represent Jews worldwide at the Olympic Games. So he was really a gymnast, but he latched onto football as a way to get into Olympics. Lord Mond, who was a real football fan, latched onto football.
Well, Lord Mond sponsored a cup in Wales as well.
Yes,
right?
He did. It's the oldest cup, apparently.
Arthur Mond.
Yes.
Yeah.
His brother Robert Mond was one of the big archaeologists at the time. So he was digging first in Egypt, and then there was a rebellion. So he moved to Palestine and set up the big museum in Jerusalem, which at the time was called the Palestine Museum, but it's now called the Rockefeller Museum.
Okay. But I mean, so we find ourselves, come to 1928, and as we say, the first Tel Aviv derby, Maccabi Tel Aviv versus Hapoel, Allenby Tel Aviv, and as you say, the derby was sponsored by Lord Mond. Mm. This is huge in terms of, I mean, you could say world football history, but certainly Israeli, Palestine football history. This is the first derby in 1928. This is years before huge footballing countries have even got proper league set up and all that kind of stuff. So how did the game play out?
They were very, very worried about crowd violence. So
because of the rivalries between
the because
two
of sides. The rivalries. So they banned rattles, which were these big heavy wooden rattles.
Yeah, that's how you do it. That's how you pacify the crowd.
But people were drinking before the game. So there was a bar on Allenby Street, and that's where all the Hapoel, all the workers gathered. Mm-hmm. And then there was another bar, which at the time was really on the borders of Jaffa in an area that's now called Shabazz. Tel Aviv's got bigger, so it's now within Tel Aviv. But at the time, it was in the kind of the red light area. So that's where the Maccabees were meeting. Right. they were drinking in the red light district. Right. And the Hapoel ones were drinking in Allenby. And then they all kind of congregated and came down what was now Carmel Market towards the Palm Court, which was the name of the football ground at the time. It was called the Palm Court because there were just a couple of palm trees by the side of it. But the joke was that the big hotels always called their ballrooms the Palm Court. And so they were joking that their kind of scrappy little football ground was a glamorous.
Right. So the match was won 3-0 by Maccabi.
Yes, it was. It
sounds fairly comprehensive.
It does, and there aren't that many reports of quite why it went like that. But the story is that Hapoel just didn't have their best players. Noodleman, who was played for Hapoel for about 10 years, he was a very small man, but apparently just a really, really fast winger. There's a poem dedicated to him that was written by the guy who at the time was kind of the national poet of the Jews of Palestine, called Alexander Penn. And that was printed on the front page of a newspaper. So Noodleman was quite good, but he couldn't play for some reason. There was another guy called Willy Berger, who was, again, was a Hungarian.
Something you wouldn't want to see on a menu, isn't it?
Yeah. If he was...
There are too many, isn't there, John?
He was a professional goalkeeper from Hungary. He played for VAC.
Yeah.
Now VAC is a Budapest equivalent of Hakora. They were the sort of militant Zionist team. Mm-hmm. They'd initially wanted to call themselves the Jewish Athletic Association, mm-hmm. and they'd been prevented from doing that because there was at a time in Hungary there was a ban on overtly religious names for sporting organisations.
I see.
So they chose the name VAC, which stands for whatever the Hungarian for fencing and athletic club is. But the reason they chose it is because the V and the A, if you superimpose them on each other, you can form the Star of David.
Very clever.
But it was never as... I mean, I think this tells you a lot about the differences of the Jewish experience in Budapest and Vienna, that the Zionist team in Budapest was never anywhere near as successful as the one in Vienna. I mean, famously, Herzl called Hungary the withered vine on the tree of Jewry because he was so furious that he wouldn't get behind it, the Zionism. But we're drifting off a point, but partly because Jews were so well assimilated in Hungary at the time, although obviously it didn't take long for that to fall apart after the First World War.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Willy Berger had been kind of poached from a Hungarian team with a promise that if he came over to Palestine, he would tour America with a team from Haifa. And he got over to and realised that this was just complete fantasy. There was just no tour, no likelihood
of any
tour.
It's just incredible how many of these tours were being planned at any one time.
People moan about teams doing tours nowadays, don't they? Well,
so he got a job coaching in Tiberias on the Lake Galilee instead. Because of Lord Mond's money, the Maccabee Association was setting up new associations all over the country. They set up a new one in the Galilee, and he coached there. Berger coached there for a while and then got poached to play for Allenby. But the match must either have been just before his time or he hadn't been registered in time, because for some reason he wasn't playing that day. But he was playing a couple of months later, and that's when they met again.
Yeah.
And Allenby beat them.
Amazing. Well, I mean, we sort of bring it more up to date, because the Tel Aviv derby is still quite a big one, and that's where it started in 1928. But am I right in saying Hapoel still the red side, if you like, of Tel Aviv?
Yeah, it's still regarded as the red side, and it's got a really strong Labour history behind it, and it tends to be the team supported by even the Palestinians of Jaffa, the Arab population of the kind of Jaffa Tel Aviv conurbation,
sure,
would support Hapoel because of the red team, and because the trade union movement allows some way for Palestinians to engage politically.
Mm-hmm. And there might not be an easy answer to this, but why do you think when in Britain football clubs were very much small organic movements, maybe a church would set up a club, but it wouldn't be the club of the church as a whole, it would be the club of St. Anne's Church in Lytham or whatever. Why do you think in Palestine the clubs immediately felt the need to affiliate with much wider, much bigger bodies?
I think to start off with, there was a genuine dispute between the bosses, who were Russian and right wing, and the newcomers, who were workers, left wing, and liked football more. So we had that resentment that their game was being badly managed. And then they spread out across the country. So at first it's that, but also there were, even as early as 1926, there was a real disappointment that the Maccabee organisation under Yekutieli was thinking about the Olympics instead of thinking about self-defence. So even in 1926, the first kind of alternative had been formed, which was the forerunner of Betar, which is the great, kind of ultra right wing or sports association. And there's really only three sports associations in Israel. It's Maccabee, Hapoel, and Betar.
Okay,
there you are. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've come to the end of our time, but if you do want to know more about this, then do check out Nicholas's new book, More Noble Than War: A Soccer History of Israel Palestine. Fascinating stuff indeed. Thank you very much, Nicholas.
Thanks very much.
Absolute pleasure. As always, Jonathan, thank you.
Cheers.
And thank you for listening to The Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. Issue 34 of The Blizzard is now available. Go to theblizzard.co.uk for more information there. We'll see you next week.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.